in February, we're pretty much right at that same point today. Carrying on with this theme, the principal, let's talk about the principal on page 3, is made up of $6.9 billion of dedicated oil revenue, and then about two-thirds of it is through appropriations, 6.3, the inflation-proofing appropriation, and then special appropriations, which have typically been transfers from the earnings account into principal.
Representative,
just to put a little finer point on that for folks on gavel to gavel, two-thirds, 66% of permanent fund is because the legislature chose to put the money there. And for those that like the demagogue that we're trying to raid the permanent fund, please read these numbers.
You're correct. 66% is through appropriations into principal. On page 4, you'll see the breakdown of the earnings reserve account. This reflects a comment from Representative Hudson. $2.4 billion of the earnings reserve account is in unrealized income. That's appreciation of the assets. $3.6 billion of the earnings reserve account is in realized income. As Alan Moore indicated earlier, we track this for accounting purposes, but they both the principal and earnings reserve are fully invested.
The unrealized income, 2.4, is that down marginally because the earnings for equities are down, we're down?
Earnings, equities have been down for the first 6 months, yes. Okay. On page 5, you'll see the projection sheet that we produce monthly with our financial statements. The chart is basically set up in three sections across the page. Principal is in the first block, the income is in the second block, and then the total fund value is on the right side of the page. The fiscal years are shown down the left side of the page and also then again on the right side of the page. Each line across the page shows you the values. The first 5 years of actual results are shown. Then the gold bar across the middle of the page is our current fiscal year projection. And again, that projection includes 6 months of actual data and then 6 months of a projection. And we're using 6 months of projected the capital market assumptions provided by Cowen. And we'll walk through that current year in a minute. And then the bottom half of the page reflects our current projections using the median 5-year rate of return of 8.25, and then the constant rate of inflation of 3.25%. Again, there's no market volatility projected in this model. It's just a straight line linear projection.
The 3.25% was what, Chris?
Was the inflation rate. It was part of the Cowen capital market assumption.
So you have bumped it up from 3 to 3.2.
3.25 is also the rate we used last year.
It is.
If I could, and the year before, right, it was 3%.
Representative Bundy?
Yes, thank you. The column labeled dividends, is that the PFD you're talking
that
about?
Is this, that is the dividend that we transfer over to the Department of Revenue. If we could just walk
in billions, 163 billion. Right.
If we could, I'll just walk you quickly across the current fiscal year FY01. We began the year with about 20 billion in principal. We're projecting the end of year balance to be around 21 billion. That includes the dedicated oil revenue. This is using the fall forecast we received from Department of Revenue, and then the inflation proofing addition to principal of about 687 million. Now, that is using a 3.37% inflation rate that we do know is the rate we're going to use this year. Moving 3.37%, because the statutes require the change in the last two calendar years. And because the calendar year is over, we do know that rate.
Mm-hmm.
Moving across the page, the counting net income is about 598 million. As you can see, that's below where it's been historically for the last few years. Through the first 6 months of the year, the fund is down 1.5%. But we're projecting a total return for the year of about 2.25%. That's using 6 months of actual return and then projecting forward using the capital market assumptions for the next 6 months. Mm-hmm. Statutory net income we're projecting for the year of 1.6 billion. That's about a 6.3% realized return. And as you move across the page, the dividend is projected to be about $9 million less than last year's projected lump sum payment. And then you'll see the inflation proofing number that actually moves from earnings to principal, and then the projected.
Representative Bundy?
So this would be the first time in the life of the PFD that it would actually go down next year rather than go up.
I think there were, Mr. Chairman, sorry, but I think somewhere in the 80s it may have dropped modestly, and this one it almost depends on the day with the volatility we are experiencing, whether the dividend, the income, the impact on the income, whether the dividend is slightly larger or slightly smaller.
I think many of the public have come to assume it would go up every year, and I point out that, as you say, depending on volatility, that is not necessarily the case.
We appreciate that. We try to set that expectation as well.
Chris, with inflation proofing, you reflected that last year the permanent fund calculated or estimated inflation to be 3.25, and again this year 3.25. Last year the appropriation for actual appropriation was $423 million. This year, based on 3.25, you're projecting it's going to be $687 million. So I mean, it was, you over projected last year, and appears you're going to, you know, that depending upon it. Well, the bottom line is you overprojected last year.
Last year's inflation rate came in at about 219.
And how, what is it tracking right now? Is it looking?
Right now we're going to be using 3.37% for the inflation rate, and we do know that for a fact. Because as I mentioned in the statutes, it says take the change in the CPI for the last two calendar years, and because the calendar year is 12/31, we do know that change was 3.37%.
Okay, so that 687 is a pretty hard number.
Pretty good number, of course, depending on what level of principal we end the year at.
Right. Yep.
To the right of the income box, you'll see what we're projecting for the realized earnings reserve account and the unrealized earnings reserve account for the year end. They're both showing a decrement for this year. And the total fund on the far right, you'll see that we are projecting to end at almost exactly where we are today, $26.2 billion. Again, this projection sheet reflects no market volatility. It's just a smooth, constant return of 8.25, which is the median expected return from the Cowen capital market assumptions, and 3.25% inflation. It would certainly be naive to think that we could predict this outcome with certainty. And forecasting specific results, as you can see here, assumes a level of precision that's just not possible. So for those reasons, we also use a volatility model. And I'd like to show you some results of that volatility model on the next page. We periodically run a volatility model about every 6 months. So the last volatility model we've run is using data from the end of the fiscal year, June 30, 2000. This chart shows an array of expected outcomes, and I'd like to sort of explain how to read the chart by looking at the far right FY06 range of market value outcomes that we're expecting. The top quartile box reflects a 25% chance that the market value of the fund will be $40 billion or greater. You could also say that the bottom quartile box tells you that there's a 25% chance that the fund value at the end of FY06 will be $30 billion or less, with a median expected value of about $34.5 billion. Another way that you might want to read this is that 50% of the time you can expect value for the ending market value to be between the top and bottom quartile value. So 50% of the time it would be between $40.3 billion and $30.2 billion. Again, this is taking the market volatility into account. Going forward, I've shown you some volatility graphs for different values within the fund. The next page shows you the volatility and the expected outcome of the principal balance over the next six fiscal years. Page 8 shows you the volatility of and the expected outcomes of the statutory net income values for the next six fiscal years. Page 9, again, the same way to read these graphs, shows you the total earnings reserve projected outcomes for the next six fiscal years. And then on page 10, I'd like to stop for just a minute. As you've heard earlier today, the permanent fund transfers one lump sum for the dividend over to the Department of Treasury. The permanent fund dividend division actually accepts the applications, determines the number of applicants that are qualified, and then calculate the dividend. But we can never seem to leave an audience without first talking about the dividend. So here you would read again that in FY06, the top quartile, there's a 25% chance the dividend will be about $2,850, and about a 25% chance it'll be $1,560 or less.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bundy.
So that'd be a factor of the number of applicants for the PFD,
right,
rather than, even though we saw the lower earnings projected.
And the market volatility through the years.
Combination, right.
Combination of the two.
Chris, this graph was done based on December 31st?
This chart using the volatility model is based on June 30, 2000 numbers, so the last fiscal year data.
Oh, okay, because my understanding is that we're looking at the bottom quartile for
exactly
range of dividend for this current year.
Exactly. If the projection comes through exactly as shown, which of course is highly unlikely, but if it comes in exactly as we predict, the FY01 dividend would fall just below the bottom quartile number. And the last slide I just draw your attention to is page 11.
Chris, so what you're saying then is if it comes through in the bottom quartile, the dividend will actually go down next year as opposed to what we've witnessed over the past few years of going up.
Exactly.
So, and that would be somewhere in the $1,960 range, as opposed to the median case where you projected it being over 2,000,
exactly. 2050. Yes, you're right.
So in that, the downward shift is a manifestation or an accurate reflection then of the markets, equity markets going down and having a real impact then on the dividend.
Exactly.
What I'm trying to emphasize is the legislature didn't spend the money. Representative Hudson.
Chris, the FY01, it's the common dividend.
Yes, it is.
The only one we just gotten is the 2000.
Exactly. The final page I draw your attention to is our website, and I just like to remind you that monthly we produce our financial statements and put them up on the website. Our monthly financial statements also include the linear projection model, and we also show our performance on the website. So it's easy to access the information. And that concludes my remarks, unless you have any questions.
Any questions for Chris? Thank you, Chris.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to invite Mr. Maynard Mitchell and Bufford up to speak about how they use this information to manage.
Chairman?
Yes, Representative Hudson.
Sometime before all of these distinguished ladies and gentlemen get away from here, I would really like to have them speak about a conversion to a market value.
Percent of market value?
Percent of market value for distribution, and what that would mean to the investment potentials of the entire fund.
Okay.
I'd like to start with Robert Maynard, who is the Chief Investment Officer at the Public Employees Retirement System of Idaho.
Welcome back, then.
Thank you very much. I must admit it's a pleasure being here, and although I enjoyed my 7.5 years of sitting in this seat twice a year, it's much easier when your budget's not at stake to make comments. Also, too, I'm pleased to see that clock still doesn't work. So
you tried.
Still difficult to figure out how long you've been talking sometimes.
The illusion of time standing still when you're there.
That's exactly right. Now how time flies and you're having fun. It is a real pleasure to be back, and it's been an interesting time. Right now, I am now the Chief Investment Officer of the Public Employees Retirement System of Idaho. I also happen to be chair of the endowment committees of a couple of universities and colleges in the Idaho area. And over the past number of years, I've spent a fair amount of time helping out a number of trusts and funds, not only in the U.S., but overseas. And I thought it'd be helpful and take about 5 to 10 minutes to give some observations. I used to be deputy executive director of the permanent fund before I left. And just some comparative observations as to now I see the fund in a different light, having worked in a different perspective over the last number of years. And I'd like to make three, I believe. I could talk for a long time. And some of you know me, sometimes I do talk for a long time. But I think the three I'd like to make are, first, that there is one strength the permanent fund has had over the years, and it's more obvious to me now than ever before. Every governor has appointed trustees to the permanent fund who are experienced, common sense, and that without exception, they have looked at their duties on the fund without any agenda of their own. That has been a tradition of this fund that you should not take lightly. When you look at funds elsewhere and the funds that have been in trouble, the funds that kind of go down the drain, it's because that the leadership at the top has tended to either become partisan, become agendized, or they haven't taken the care and time to do so. It is obvious once you see a lot of other funds that the board of the permanent fund has traditionally been one of the best, not only in the nation, but in the world. And I think people start to take that for granted. Every governor has done a very good job without regard to a partisan thing to make sure they appoint excellent people to that fund. And I commend that to your attention as it goes forward. Don't take that for granted. There's been a number of places that's turned around very quickly. But as long as you have that sort of quality being taken care of by the governors and by the legislature overseeing, I think you won't go far wrong. The business of investing is not that tough from the top down. It's not. I think we've all been ruined by CNBC to think that it really is a bottom-up hectic, let's pick the right thing. If you don't, you're down the drain. It's not like that. There's long-term, stable policies done by very bright people with good common experience, with good staff advising them. You will not go wrong. So all of these minor things in between are more transitory. But please keep attention to that. Second, you do have a couple of problems that you're going to have to face, the board has to face, and you as a legislature, I believe, are going to have to face. You have to realize that the business of investing is not like CNBC gives it. It is not trying to pick the best stocks or bonds. Instead, it is all about trying to invest to meet your liabilities. Investment policies and investment programs depend crucially on the nature of the obligations that you're trying to fund. I mean, obviously, if you have an operation next year that's going to save your life and you have the money in hand, it is foolish to put the money in the stock market. Cash is where you want to put it, because even though you might make more in the stock market, you need that money for a certain obligation. Whereas if you're trying to fund your kids' college education 18 years out, cash is a bad place to put it, even if you could pay this year's tuition, because obviously the college tuition is going to be different 18 years out. That's why you need stocks, and cash would be stupid. Every other investment fund in the world looks first to its obligations and liabilities, what it needs to invest for, and then decides what it's going to invest in. That's true of the pension fund I work with in Idaho. We have our liabilities set out. That's true of the pension fund here, by the way. That is also true of the endowment funds I chair for the University of Boise State University and Albertson College, because there's obviously a plan to spend that money. At the center of the permanent fund right now, there is a hole. They have not been given what they are supposed to make. If you look at the way the whole statutes are put together, it basically works out, you guys make it, then we'll decide how to divvy it up. That puts the board in a very difficult position as to try to what to decide for. Do they try to get to a certain level of dividends? Do they try to get to a certain level of dividends plus some amount for state spending? I mean, that's still kind of left in the air. The reason it's becoming more important now is that the accumulation phase of the permanent fund is pretty much over. Now you're in the maintenance and in the debate as to what point, if ever, you have to go in and use it for other purposes. But at some point, somebody's going to have to step up and say, here's what you've got to try to make. And then when the permanent fund comes back and says, here's how we have to invest to make it, someone has to make a decision, does that incur too much risk? You probably can go for a few more years before you have to make that choice, but it's going to come to you one of these days.
Representative Bundy.
Maybe I'm oversimplifying, but I thought the mission of the corporation was something like we manage salmon for maximum sustained yield. And we haven't set a target as to how much they should make, but what they make then falls into a formula for disbursement. And
right.
I misunderstand that.
You're correct on what it is right now. It does, whatever they make falls into a formula for disbursement. But all of our funds, after Alan's fund, my fund, everybody else, we reverse that process. Someone tells us, here's what we need the money to spend for, because like I was saying before, if you need to make more and your obligations are inflation adjusted, I have to go up by inflation, and you have a timeline of 20 years, you tend to invest more in stocks because you're trying to get to that goal with the least amount of risk because there's risk involved. If you're shorter in, you tend to go more towards bonds. That decision as to how much to go to stocks and bonds depends crucially on the nature of when you what you need to spend when. You don't have, you were right, right now the statutes and the rules don't give a goal to reach. It says try to make as much as you can, but it doesn't necessarily say how, what level, and whatever. For example, if you said you want to double the fund in 10 years, in 7 years, you may need to make 10% per year. If you want to double the fund in 10 years, you need to make 7% per year. You would have two different investment regimes to try to reach 10% a year rather than 7. Right now, there's no outside standard to say what that is. Like for my pension fund, I have a stream of liabilities I have to meet, and I know what I need to make by certain years. That sets my investment policy. That's the issue.
Doesn't that inhibit you far more than it does the corporation? The corporation, we have not said in 10 years we want X dividend. We've said in 10 years, let the market and your management determine what the dividend is.
To refine that question, Bob, I mean, we attempted to provide that clarity of focus a couple years ago, or a year and a half ago, and that was rejected. To what extent, or what's our time frame before that lack of clarity or definition begins negatively impacting the permanent fund and the board?
I guess the bigger problem for the board, and they've handled it quite well, is that it is left up to them without any clear guidance from the legislature as to what level to try to reach and with what volatility to do so. It makes it difficult to continue a consistent policy over changing boards, changing administrations, to make that consistent. At some point, someone's going to have to step up and say, otherwise it's to default to the board. And the issue is that the right place to default to? It puts the board in a tough position because then they're subject to criticism, because if they try to make a bit more by more equities and the equity market goes through a 72 to 74 recession, people look at them and say, why did you do that?
We don't pay them because we love them.
That's true.
They take some risks just like we do.
That's right.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you. Mr. Maynard, some of us over the last few years have been trying to set up a distribution on the basis of market value. Right. That is an average of, say, 8.25% and 3% inflation proofing, and then splitting the balance of the earnings on an annual basis, a percent into dividends and then a percent into government. Or, although we've never been able to get that percent for government through the system here. But isn't that similar to what you're talking about?
That was actually going to be my third point. Third thing I've noticed, having had now a clear framework for the liability stream and on endowment funds, a clear spending rule, which is almost all endowments have a percentage of market value, the distribution mechanism and payout mechanism here is pretty kludgy. Kludgy, to make a very technical term out of it. I mean, it's very difficult to understand. I mean, you can see all the projections, how there's feedback mechanisms. Plus, two, you're using the old, which is rarely used except for tax accounting anymore, the old distinction between realized and unrealized gains. That is not used in current investment practice. I mean, it's kind of like saying you have a pool of water, you take some out, you say, I've realized this gain. You got to reinvest it, so you pour it back in the pool. You know, the distinction is a difficult distinction. I can tell you, even after I used to understand the system very, very well, coming back to it again after, 6 years or so, it makes little sense to me. And, the problem is, and it's not so much that this percentage of market value makes any difference on the dividend payout or whatever, although I'm very aware you had that election which had huge majorities for no change at all, so everybody's going to look at any change probably in the near future as some secret attempt to get into the fund to change it. But the real problem you're going to have to face is that this payout rule you have right now is not transparent. It's not easy to oversee. I mean, if I was sitting in your chair, it would confuse the living daylights out of me to say, what is actually going on here? What sorts of things can the fund do? How does taking capital gains or not taking capital gains to realize or unrealize income affect the payout going forward? I mean, you had a big capital gains taking a few years ago. That may be coming in now as part of the reason it's going down. Who knows? It's very difficult to see. But at some point, as the legislature has to face the issue of maybe giving more specific goals and then tracking and monitoring, this lack of transparency is going to make it very difficult, because that ability to monitor really crucially depends on a simple area to see. And that's, I think, probably the major advantage of looking at the legislation and the amendment that they support. I mean, I think my guess is it probably won't go anywhere, but the issue is it's a good idea to keep looking at that, simply to keep yourself reminded that overseeing how this thing operates, it can be more transparent, it can be more simple, it can be more clear, and I would recommend at least looking at it and on a year-to-year basis, and maybe the climate will change at some point to make such changes. But overall, I would say the longer I'm away, the more that I have come to the conclusion that the pride that Alaskans take in the permanent fund is well placed. What has been done here with regard to the tradition, expertise, and respect and credibility is tremendous. It's rarely seen to have lasted for 2.5 decades. I've rarely seen a fund, and you look out and you see most funds, you lose that respect and dignity once, and it never comes back. And don't take it for granted. You've been very fortunate on that, and don't take it for granted at all. But it's a pleasure to be back, and I'll now retreat.
Now I'd like to introduce Jerry Mitchell, Mr. Chair. Jerry, as I noted, the retired partner at Wellington Asset Management, and was instrumental in starting up their international equity team.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you, I'm very pleased to be here. I was an investment manager for over 30 years, and so my comments are going to be from the perspective of someone who's been in the trenches, who's actually run money, rather than the perspective of someone who supervised it. So I have two comments to make, and they're from that perspective. First, I've reviewed the capital market assumptions which Mr. O'Leary presented, and the fund's position in bonds, stocks, and real estate as Mr. Moore presented, and the financial outlook presented by Ms. Phillips. Like all assumptions and projections and outlooks, they're not sure things. In fact, very little about investing is sure, and that's why I believe investment management is an art as well as a science. But the process which the public fund here, the permanent fund, is embracing is a sound process. And what I've learned in the past day from the Board of Trustees and the staff and my two colleagues here encourages me to believe that the fund's investment process will become even sounder, even better in the future. It's been my experience that assumptions and outlooks and projections and models and forecasts can go only so far. And it's the implementation of investment policy that really counts. So what I'm going to be doing in my role on the Investment Advisory Committee over the next year is to ask, can the ideas discussed in meetings like this, can the projections which consultants make, can the discussions which the board has, can all these things actually be implemented? Can they be translated into action? Can the board and the staff and the outside managers really do what all the numbers and all the graphs and all the charts show? Because whether it's football or politics or personal budgeting or running a $26 billion fund, it's the execution and the implementation, as well as the planning, that makes a difference. So that's what I'll be looking at. What's my impression so far? From my perspective, I think that the permanent funds plans, as I understand them, can be successfully implemented with the support and with the assistance of all the people in this room. And I look forward to seeing it happen. One other additional comment on the idea of payout rates based on rolling market periods. I think it's a very good idea. I think it's been adopted by virtually all the endowment or quasi-endowment funds I've been involved in, and it gives everyone a greater measure of security and predictability than they'd have without it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, I say I'd like to introduce Alan Buckner, as I noted earlier. He's the treasurer of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and oversees their foundation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to go right to the heart of it with only one preemptory comment, and that is to seek your patience, if I may sound a little pedantic. I get that from the brethren in the academy, whom I usually see every day. But I, Bob Maynard has, I think, laid out the question particularly well, and what I think is the major challenge here. And I will reference this from the MIT perspective with some emphasis in a couple of areas. We formulate our investment policy with a very substantive and multi-year understanding of liability streams, because the endowment at MIT is a major component of support of the operating budget. In terms of one of the issues that we would not be able to tolerate in our system, I'm going to make reference to Ms. Phillips' presentation, specifically page 5 of that presentation, and really some of the colloquy which took place around it. And that was to note that there was a possibility that the dividends were going to go down year to year. I do not know, I'm not familiar enough with the background in terms of whether that's a population-adjusted factor in terms of then looking on a per individual basis in terms of the payout. But I would comment to you that if the distribution made available to support the MIT operating budget were to go down in a following year, they probably would have a new treasurer. So as a policy mandate within our structure, our payout to support the operating budget, number one, does not go down. Number two is that policy mandate also recognizes that year to year we are going to have increases on the expense side of our activities. And that relates in part to the CPI discussion that you had before, because it is also true in our environment, if we're supporting the budget, not only do we have to protect the purchasing power of the capital, but we have to assume, all other things being equal, that the costs of operating the institution are going to rise year to year. One of the things that also falls from that is what is the appropriate inflation index number to use. There was a lot of discussion about what the inflation index number is in the real world, but the question is, what is the inflation index number that wants to guide the policy? Let me draw the distinction for you. A university has about 70% of its costs tied up in labor costs. In general, our labor costs year to year rise at a faster rate than the general CPI. So our inflation index with respect to protecting purchasing power and our inflation index with respect to sort of year to year support of the operating budget is a number that's larger than the CPI. And I would suggest to you that as you focus on this question of protecting purchasing power of the permanent fund, that there needs to be some consideration about what kind of purchasing power one is talking about in this area. It may be the general CPI. I'm not suggesting that it should not be. I'm merely saying that that's part that needs examination. The second part of this is to emphasize that it is this definition of the liability stream which becomes the guide point for what one can do in terms of the asset allocation area. And I would make a second point. There is a constraint by limiting total equity exposure of the fund. To press on the one hand towards maximizing return, but at the same time be limiting the amount of exposure that could be in the equity markets is not a construct which seems to me to provide maximum flexibility and an opportunity to take opportunities in those markets. So where this comes from is that you can't get reward if you don't take risk. If you wind up constraining the capacity to take risk, then you are by definition limiting what you can expect to come out of the fund. And you then travel down further into the question of the key liabilities, and if you're not meeting those liabilities as you may define them, then the constraints have to also be examined as well as defining the liability stream.
Mr. Buffer, to emphasize or try to capture that thought, are you saying or suggesting that the constraints that we've put upon them are restraining their ability to gain greater return?
I'm saying two things. In the first part, I'm saying my reading, I think the fund has to speak for it. I'm only commenting as an observer with one meeting under the belt, somewhat presumptive. I'm saying, first of all, it is uncertain to me what the liability obligation is of the fund, part one.
It is to everybody in this state.
I understand that.
Or at least in this building.
Part two is, in the context of perhaps the loosely formed understanding of what the objectives may be, I believe that the policy is too constraining. Okay?
Right.
Now, as an example, going back also to Bob's comments, if the liability issue is a short-term issue, then the fund, even if it had the flexibility to be more equity-oriented, to take more risk, it probably should not do so because the short-term risk is too high relative to a defined liability in the short term. To give you the contrast, but not to suggest the reason I'm hesitating is I can describe to you the equity allocations or equity-like allocations of the major privately endowed universities in the United States, the largest ones. What I'm hesitating about is to take the view that that's the appropriate asset allocation policy for the permanent fund. It is the proper asset allocation policy for the major private endowments in terms of the universities because it maps well with their defined liabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So the sequence has to start with defining liabilities. But the bulk of the population of the 30 largest private endowments in the United States are centered about 80 to 85% equity or equity-like instruments.
Right.
That is a substantially different risk tolerance than is evident in the context of the constraints on the permanent fund. But emphasis with respect to how the liabilities are defined. That's part one. The second part of it, which is really important, is how do we make distributions from that endowment? How do we deal with the question of the inherent volatility of taking more exposure to equity or equity-like markets? We do it by making our payouts on a smoothing formula. And the smoothing formula is only one part of that scenario. The other is what I will call the accounting treatment of the numbers. We do not use statutory definitions in terms of what is income. They're sort of classical trust definitions of realized capital gains, interest, and dividend income. We make our payouts on an averaging measure of the total market value. In the MIT case, we do the smoothing not over 3 years, but over 36 months. So we're really technically taking the average of an average 3 years. So it is, I have not sort of tried to model out how that looks against five-year endpoints, mm-hmm. but it is clearly dampening sort of market volatility over that time period, and it is measuring total market value without any cognizance of whether or not there are realized capital gains or whether or not the interest and dividend income was up or not. So it is, that is the last component of my comments here. And I just want to sort of, as button items, go back to it. Liability definition. After that, opening up the boundaries with respect to the asset allocation. And third, to smooth the payout structure by using a smoothing formula. And secondly, make that smoothing formula relate to a total investment return rather than to a definition of earned income in a classical sense. Thank you.
Representative Derby's in the budget.
Yeah, can you say a little bit about what the what percent of market value payout rate is? And in that, I'm interested in your comment that you made earlier that you know, your budgets don't go down. So do you also have, maybe you could say what you meant by treatment of money. Do you also have some mechanism whereby you, in fact, guarantee that it, or you attempt to keep from having a reduced payment on
it? Right, right. It's in our rule set. It's on our distribution rule set. But let me back up and the analogy to how money comes into the permanent fund may not be the same as what it is at MIT or a number of other colleges, but I can describe the strategic frame of reference in terms of our particular case. We have three basic sources of revenue in an institution. Tuition revenue is one source. And in the political question, the rate at which one can continue to increase tuition in real terms, net of scholarships and grants, which in our case is needs blind in its structure, in terms of admissions. So we're committed to supporting every student that qualifies for entrance, and so you have a certain inherent volatility in terms of what might be called net tuition. That has been for a long period of time about 25% of our total expenditures on an annual basis. It is difficult for us to project that that number is going up as a percent. sort of put aside. A second area is in the case of MIT and many of the other private universities, which have heavy research programs, the question of sponsored research, whether it comes from the public sector or the private sector. And that, in the case of MIT, used to be a larger fraction of our revenues than it is today. In absolute dollars, it's gone up, but relative to the size of the activity, it's gone down. It was 50 years ago, close to 60% of our total operations, and is today much closer to 35%. The third source in which I think you can draw an analogy is gifts and earnings on the assets. And years ago, that was a very small fraction of our total expenses, on the order of 15 to 20%. We are currently at about in the low 30s, and we are driving that number. We expect that number is going to be 40 to 45% of our total expenses in 2010. Having defined that kind of a model and also defining our expense model, we define a particular objective that we've got to reach with respect to the capacity of the endowment to support operations. And what comes out of that, and then you have a spending rule, and in our case, it's 5% of the lagging 36 months is available for consumption. There's a subsidiary rule which says that it shall not be less than the prior year. So the risk for us, and we try to model that risk, is the probability that you're going to have a stretch of time in which market values are just eroding away, so that when you apply the formula, you're going to lose sort of the amount that you're distributing for support of operations. Now, I would suggest to you that there have been very few times in history where that would have occurred. 73, 74 was one of those times. In 75 and 76, MIT technically decapitalized its assets to meet its operating budget. And it did it by freezing the support from what it had been over that time period. In subsequent years, we got it back, and essentially it was restored in terms of maintaining purchasing power.
If I could hit that point real quick, I mean, it's similar, but it's different in the sense that your return, that 5%, is driven part by the fact of what your earnings are, but also by the fact that your counterpart, perhaps is the person that works for you, in terms of development, i.e., gets back to it's got to continue to perform.
That's correct.
Perform extremely well. Yeah. So it seemed to me, in some ways, 5% would be a very conservative index for you.
If I might respond to that, in terms of where 5% came about, it's a there's a piece of work. I think, Bob, we could probably pull that out when McGeorge Bundy was chair of the Ford Foundation in the late 60s. There was a major study done by the Ford Foundation that looked at the whole question of spending rates from endowments and was specifically talking about the university area, which is a very different than a foundation area.
Right.
And the long-term track, and I think it goes back to some of Michael's numbers also, the long-term track of the real return to be expected from financial assets is on the order of 5%. Now, Michael's data suggests it's 6.5 to 7%, but I would note that if you look at some of his curves, we have just come through an extremely unusual period in terms of market returns. And in fact, if we were sitting here in 1982, looking back on the history, we might come to different conclusions about what the spending rate should be. Go ahead, Bob.
Oh no, I just going to mention 5% also is the. Actually, it turns out to be the spending rule for the endowments I'm on. Plus, two, if you look at the my retirement system, I need to make 5% above inflation over rolling 6-year periods to meet the liabilities without getting fired. But that goes back to the point of that 5%. If you're going to try to make 5% real, you need to have at least 70% equities. And that's what the point that Alan was making, that if that turns out to be the stream you want, the artificial constraints put on the fund by the statutes now would make it impossible for them to reach 5% real with any sort of realistic ability to do it, because you've got to get at least 70% equities. They can't get there. On the other hand, if the state is willing to say, we don't want to make that much over the long term, we're more short-term oriented, and we want maybe 3% real, then you're probably fine with the current constraints. But you can't put the constraints in first and then go out and say, make as much as you can, because it, that long-term investment, that means they got to start market timing. And we don't know of any successful market timers
right.
They have
out
there. Constraints, well, notwithstanding that when I left the university, people told me I was leaving a very serious political arena for just the legislature. But even at MIT, I think the politics for managing money are less than what we have for managing people's money. And of the three points that you had mentioned, the smoothing probably can be done internally and with not a lot of angst in the public. But the other two, I really question. Key liabilities, unless and until the earnings go to the general fund, there's no key liability, because the PFD is found money. And if it's 2,000 or if it's 1,500, it's found money for the public. And so there isn't a key liability in the public's mind, I don't think, certainly not in my mind. Here are some pretty conservative sideboards. Do the best you can within those sideboards. And if you only make 1%, it's not going into the general fund, it's going into the public as found money. And so I don't see a liability there. It could change, but we've had some experience that says change is difficult in this arena.
I only make the point that the liability does not necessarily mean state government spending. You could also have, for example, a policy that said you want the dividend to follow a certain track, always going up, including with reasonable population, and that would require them to be more aggressive, because as you can see, there is a good chance now that it could go down.
I don't think that at least many in the legislature would want that, because that makes it even more difficult to face the eventual realities that this ought to be paying in some fashion, some portion of expenses of general government rather than individual reward and the whole IRS.
Yeah, with due respect, the little phrase after our names say investment advisors, it doesn't say political advisors.
So
that's our problem.
And I don't mean to be argumentative. I was just trying to put another view out.
I guess all I would say is we realize, or at least I realize from my years here, that the likelihood of something like this occurring in the next few years is difficult. But all I'm saying is that it would be well worth your while every year to seriously look at that issue, so you can remind yourself of the issues as are coming up, and there becomes some historical memory, at least in the legislature, of the key issues that may have to be faced at some point, whether or not some eventual legislation is passed, because it does put a serious hole at the heart of the long-term stability of the investment policy of the fund, and you really are relying on the continued superb nature of the board and staff to be there all the way through, and the fund has been very lucky so far, but there may be a period where that doesn't occur.
The irony of the whole thing is, the more successful they are, the less flexibility the public will allow. If we had a huge crash and a $50 dividend, they would probably get a lot more flexibility. I have to apologize. I do have an 11 o'clock tonight.
Representative Davies will try and get this wrapped up soon.
Well, I was going to follow on some of the comments that Con was making. I think that the key thing in terms of setting up what our expected liabilities are is that we have to understand that we really are in two fundamentally different modes. One to start with is, I think, even though it's difficult to say what the public expectation is, you know, that's the political assessment that we have to make. But generally speaking, I think people generally agree that we have gone through an accumulation phase where what we're trying to do is save present wealth for future generations and future possible obligations. So we're in the trend. I see us in that transition phase now between that sort of accumulation point where we had enormous amounts of wealth short-term coming in and where we're trying to figure out how to benefit the future, either individuals or government through the government expenditure mode. And we're trying to figure out, you know, how that should look. And there is no consensus right now that there's both disagreement about what that future liability ought to be and the timing for the switch from the accumulation mode to the liability mode, if you will. And so I think that we're dealing with both of those political uncertainties right now.
Could I perhaps respond to just one aspect of it? And I realize that it's not that there is a political question that needs to be focused on. But one approach for consideration is to deal with the benefit received from individual residents and perhaps define that core liability, and I'm being really quite surface on this, but if there's a sense that it's the right number, in quotes, and having it grow by some inflation rate, which is another sense that you see that as sort of the stream going to the population, however that population may change, you will have fixed a very, very important liability. And the other side of it, which is looking at the general resources for the state, you could define in the context of some feedback from the Permanent Fund, which talks about a long-term realistic investment return objective, long-term investment return objective, that does not have consumption tied to it. My comment is, I apologize, I was trying to doodle a set of numbers. The difficulty in terms of the long-term strategy and taking a more aggressive approach, and maybe it's not the best analogy, is sitting down at a poker table. That big hand may pay off very, very nicely, but if you've continually lost money along the way, you have no resources to play that hand when you're really going to win. And my analogy about the losses is really what consumption is all about. Money leaves the fund, so to speak, and it's consumed, although the purposes are really quite appropriate. So one could define the target in terms of trying to build to some particular value, minus the liability associated with the individuals who are getting distributions, and formulate the policy in that context. And then you arrive at a new point in which you then can think about a consumption phase with respect to the state's aggregate activities. Now, that's simplistic, a lot of issues to sort of cross around there, but it's that kind of a start that I would suggest needs to be made.
You know, partially integrating two of the points that you made, Bob, and Mr. Bufford, you made in terms of it seems like the constraints that we place upon the Permanent Fund management team statutorily are somewhat unsophisticated and archaic, if you will. They get back to Bob's point, and that is the political protection that we the legislature maintain in the management and oversight. It's a political problem that we recognized early on, is that you had some real potential dangers about having a political board versus one that's really a financially responsible board. And it was the only protection the legislature maintained, was having some sort of directive over them about their allocations. And last year, you understand how difficult it was, like pulling eye teeth, to have that liberalized. To a certain extent, in the perfect world, I agree 100%. you take all the constraints off. If you want them to earn the maximum amount of money, you take all the constraints off and let them do their job. But there's a certain amount of fear and distrust still maintained. Going way off the reservation for a moment. One of my other hats I wear is co-chair of the Joint Armed Services Committee. And I've been at a number of conferences lately where there's been this question about protecting national security interests because the Chinese have entered the stock market in different ways and avenues to help them gain cash through the issuance of some equities, which directly helped their missile defense and their other military efforts. Have you seen, and then the push here, emphasis, is to try and protect national defense by having some more transparency to the investments being made by these different organization investment companies. The red face that CalPERS had when they found out that they were invested into some of these Chinese investments, which in the end helped the military. How difficult would it be or discouraging, I'm not sure the right term, but a chilling effect would it have if we provided or required some transparency about the asset purchases or what your portfolio is in relation to the overall performance? How difficult is that?
It would not be difficult to say, if you like the tobacco stock issue. You know, it's not difficult to say, here's how much we would have gained or lost as a result of that policy. If you're talking about the ease with which to put in a restriction such as don't invest in companies that have X percent tied to, that would be very difficult. You'd require a pretty large staff because the standard information you get about the companies is more accounting sheet, balance sheet information. And it doesn't necessarily say, for example, warningchina.com has, you know, one person out there who's shoveling money to the PLA. Those sorts of restrictions would be very difficult to put in place.
Can you take it back to the practical side? I mean, you know, the whole South Africa, there was a push, you know, to try and basically force them away from apartheid. Taking that back to the Chinese case, my sense is that it's very difficult to put mandates on, as much as if you put some transparency to it, it may put peer pressure there, as opposed to the restriction requirement. Is that a fair assessment?
Can I just add two comments there? The first is, which this is a little tongue-in-cheek, but I think it's really important. When you get to questions like that, if you give an individual an opportunity to pick the endpoints of a measuring period, one can prove either side of the argument. I can demonstrate to you that the restrictions with either South Africa or with respect to tobacco stocks was damaging, and I can also prove to you that it was helpful. All you have to do is allow me the freedom of picking the endpoints, and I don't mean short endpoints, I mean large endpoints in terms of where you're looking at that. So it's one of the difficulties in terms of sort of analyzing it. The best descriptor that I've heard in this area, and it probably was more related to South Africa because of the magnitude of what the effect was at the time, is goes back a little bit to my earlier comment about increasing the envelope in terms of the opportunity set. It's clear that if the opportunity set is larger, that one has a better opportunity in terms of making returns. One commentator in the days of the South Africa discussion, in examining the broad U.S. market, specifically the S&P 500, and issues of who was or was not doing business in South Africa, said, it's like sitting down to play a poker game in which the other players are getting cards from a 52-card deck and you're getting cards from a 35-card deck. And which way do you think your chances are better? Because it was approximately one-third of the S&P 500 that was really excluded. And it's in that context where, in my judgment, from the point of view of purely the investment question, that the opportunity set is reduced, and thereby expected returns should be expected to be reduced. Just describing it that way. That's not a policy issue. That's just sort of
right. I mean, there you have the intertwining between policy and return objective, right? And I understand there is a balance. And what I'm trying to do is protect earnings potential, while at the same time allowing peer pressure perhaps to place the factor which discourages those investments.
I was just going to add, as a former international manager who's been given unusual mandates in the past, it is possible manager usually asks that the index against which he or she is going to be measured be similarly adjusted, so that you don't measure the manager against something he can't do. But if you can create a South Africa free index, a China free index, an Islamic index, or whatever, then I think you'd find some managers saying, yes, we can do that.
I guess I'm going to agree with you, Mr. Chair. There are groups out there like CalPERS that are working to improve the transparency organizations. It's not a quick fix. It takes time. But
I was encouraged to try and put together some legislation. Because of the complexity of it, I've been dragging my feet a bit, just because I on one hand, that balance between policy objective and return, I wanted to make it effective, and yet at the same time not devastating or not so time-consuming that it was counterproductive. And I could see both of those cases being. So I might actually call upon you for your expertise, if you wouldn't mind, as we try and look at this, see if it's an effective, it can be an effective tool or not.
Thank you.
Anything else, John? My only lament is the fact that I think the entire legislature should participate and should hear these discussions, because truly today we earn or have the potential of earning more money from our investments than we do from oil. We crossed that mark several years ago, and it is truly your counsel and your oversight is very valuable. At least it should be to everybody in the legislature. If they don't realize that, I think they're missing the mark. So I greatly appreciate the time and effort and energy that you folks have given us by providing us insight. I really enjoyed it. I look forward to it every year personally. I call it my own stock investment advice without having to pay the billions that you guys do. So I really appreciate it. Representative Davies?
Just one other comment on that. Lest people think that it's just the two of us here. I know that there are many legislators who are trying to double dip, as it were, and pay attention to this through the camera, and are in their offices also listening. So, and trying to carry out some of the other obligations at the same time. So, I think it's more than just the two of us that are paying attention right now. So, we certainly appreciate your being here and appreciate the breadth of investment experience that you bring, and thank you for coming.
Really appreciate it. Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's one of our most important meetings of the year, and you've been very generous in allowing us to share some of that time with you and the amount of time you've allowed us.
Well, we really appreciate it today. Gentlemen, have a good afternoon. Bob, we are recessed until 1:30.